All right. Good evening. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming this evening and supporting an exploration of the Buddhist teachings. Two quick beginning comments. For the last 8 weeks, I've been fighting off this sinus infection and a cold and hay fever and what have you. So the last three or four talks I've given, I listen to them, and they all sound like my voice is compromised. So it is a little bit tonight, and I apologize for that. The other thing, it's just an observation. I have listened to a number of talks and videotapes and then one in-person presentation by a number of well-known teachers in our particular tradition in the last couple of months. And it's been noteworthy for me that people, or at least these particular people, including Jack Kornfeld and Trudy Goodman, are discontinuing the use of mindfulness or using it much less and talking about present moment awareness or loving awareness or some other version of that. So the whole mindfulness movement has become so powerful now that a lot of people feel that it's compromising people's understanding of what we're trying to say, because what we're trying to say, in some cases it's congruent, in a lot of cases it isn't. And so I don't know that that's good or bad, but it's interesting to watch the change in the way things are presented from when we first started this, which was in the late 90s. The language has really changed. Teachers were avoiding using a lot of Dharma language. And the MBSR movement, which was just really taking off about 1996 and then just exploded for about 10 years, wouldn't mention the Buddha, wouldn't mention Dharma, wouldn't stay completely away from it now. If you go to any of their international conferences now, there's, half-day breakout sessions on the Brahma Viharas. So while back then there was an effort to kind of sanitize it for a bunch of different reasons, which were all around acceptance in the medical community and insurance reimbursement, all of that's gone now. So it's interesting to see these two different ways that the expression of this is taking place. Okay, so this talk is entitled A Lifetime of Dying and Being Reborn, and it's about causes and conditions. And I'd like to start with a little story by Ajahn Brahm, who is the abbot of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And two of our three guiding teachers, Kamala Masters and Stephen Armstrong, for years have done retreats and presented annually in Australia. Yeah, there's a real connection there. So this is a little story about mindfulness. So the story goes something like this, that there is a woman who has a servant, a housekeeper, and the housekeeper has been studying Buddhism and mindfulness. So the woman goes off for the day, does her activities, comes back, and is shocked to find that all of the furniture, or basically all the furniture in her house, has been removed. And the servant housekeeper, was there all day doing her chores. And so the woman's quite upset about it, and she wants to know what happened. And the housekeeper says, "Well, I was doing my chores, and I several men showed up in a truck and began removing your furniture, and they were very careful with it to make sure that they didn't scratch it or anything, and packed it very nicely, and then they left." And she said, "Well, what did you do?" And she said, "Well, I tried to be a good student. I know that Buddhism is about suffering and maintaining equanimity, and so I tried to note everything that had happened, and I could feel the sensations in my body and the feeling tone and my thoughts and my emotions. And if you'd like, I can repeat some of it for you, what happened. And I just looked at it very carefully. I tried to see into the true nature of what was happening, and I'm kind of pleased to report that I didn't suffer at all. So, you know, the story kind of begs the question, well, mindful of what, you know, and because mindfulness fits into a larger set of teachings about that are purposeful in nature. It's not just being mindful. So I had planned on giving a talk tonight that was about causes and conditions and being more of a technical talk, because you don't hear too many talks about this. So historically, what's the difference between a cause and a condition? And as a practical matter, I mean, it's a nice theory, but as a practical matter, why is it important? How is that helpful? How does it make you a skillful practitioner? And I'm going to do a little bit of that, but I decided to give a different talk tonight. I'm interested to see what the talk is, because I completely rewrote it today and it hasn't cooked, so I'm going to use some of it and not other parts. But what prompted the change was I got a call this morning from a longtime practitioner in the community, and it's similar to other calls I've gotten in the last couple of weeks about Stephen Armstrong. And we had put out a note about Steve having a unexpectedly, you know, completely unexpectedly, having some difficulty with his speech, and then going to the hospital and finding out that he had a brain tumor that was right on the speech center part of the brain. And they removed it, and we encouraged everybody to kind of follow this on Caring Bridge, because Stephen, Kamala, and John, you know, these three teachers have for, well, before SIM existed, but for 18 years have been shepherding first myself and then this Sangha, and have been the primary external supports for our practices. So if you're following on Caring Bridge, you know now that his diagnosis is terminal, that it turns out that the brain tumor is malignant, that it is a very rare form of brain cancer, and one that there's literally no cure for it. And so it's a, you know, it's a quality of life issue. And it's struck me, you know, how this has affected a number of people in the community, and also the difference in reactions that many of us are having and that Steve's having. You know, now he hasn't started to go through all the chemotherapy and radiation and all of that, you know, so that hasn't affected him yet, and his dysfunction is relatively small at this point. He has a little bit of trouble finding words and has more difficulty, interestingly, typing, you know, like email. But other than that, you know, his mind is just as sharp as can be, and he's in balance. And he said to me the other day that it's one of the interesting things and the difficult parts of this, you know, and you're kind of, okay, you know, here it comes, right? So the difficult part is other people's reaction to this compared to my own. And, I mean, it's entirely genuine. You know, you can just see that he is in a really equanimous place about this. And that most everybody else isn't in an equanimous place, you know. So it's, if you look at the stories, there's several suttas that are given by other people about the night the historical Buddha died. It's kind of the same thing in the sense that the younger monks in the Sangha, a whole group of the younger monks, were distraught They were really shaken by the death. Coming from a place basically of attachment and identification and individual loss. And Ananda, his cousin and attendant, and the senior member of the Sangha who would then lead the Sangha and then another group of them, it kind of recounts what they did. And it's not that it was joyful, but it was absent from the kind of loss and pain that you associate with attachment and identification. That wasn't there. And they stayed up most of the night talking primarily about the Dharma and about how the Buddha embodied the Dharma and the future of the Sangha. I would encourage you to follow Steve's The Caring Bridge. It's amazing how detailed it is, and you can feel where he's coming from. And there's a number of the group who's in a year-long program that he's teaching, and they're doing videos and chats with him, and all of their reaction is the same. It's inspirational. So, for me, watching this is an illustration of a lifetime of practice. That just doesn't happen. You're not just hit out of the blue with this. And this is a guy who, the number of things that he's doing right now, and the plans that are on the table for, another book and all kinds of things are pretty extraordinary. So it would be very easy for him to feel this enormous sense of loss. And I had a long discussion with one of our other teachers about this, and his sense of loss about what Steve is going through is the most emotional that I've known him for almost 30 years. And I've never seen that kind of response before, So I think watching it and being part of it is inspirational, and there's a real lesson in it. So it just started me thinking this morning about how this practice started and the role of death in relationship to the practice, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that in relationship to causes and conditions. And as I said, I'm not quite sure where this is going, so there's an illustration that I hope I'm going to get to that I think will make causes and conditions very real, and why it's not just theoretically valuable, but practically valuable, and I hope I get there. So the starting place for me on this is I've always felt that the story of the historical Buddha's life was not just a metaphor, but actually a model, if you study it. And there's a number of talks I've given on this. I don't know if they're still on our website, but if you look at how he practiced before his night of awakening, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, there's all of these different lessons in it that you can then directly translate into later teachings. That he did things that didn't work and then adjusted them, so you can see the relationship between the training and the practice. But the story of the Buddha, of the initial drive, the origin, the seed of his going on this search, was an experience that he had initially three different separate experiences, which he found destabilizing around old age, sickness, and death. It wasn't that he was, dissatisfied, existentially dissatisfied with the life that he had that included some money and some power. It wasn't that he had conflicts, psychological and emotional conflicts with his family or his children. It was his having a series of encounters with three separate encounters with people that shocked him and undermined how he understood his life, that it no longer felt stable, it no longer felt secure, and it no longer felt that it had the certainty that he was used to in conducting his life. And then, the genesis of the why we're here, the entire story, is this man's reaction to seeing what, you know, this is, if you look at the crowd tonight, you know, this is an older crowd. And there's going to be a lot more of what we're facing with Steve Armstrong. There's a number of people right now in this larger Sangha who are in the process of dying. Some people know about it, some people don't. So this is the nature of things. And we're in a zone where there's going to be a lot more of it. And as a community, we're going to need to talk about it and face it and learn how to grieve together and support each other. I think this is a very important thing that we need to look at. But at that point, he was, what, I think he was 27. And so he has this complete destabilization of his understanding of the world. And then he has a fourth encounter with a monk. And the monk doesn't have any of these features about him. There is this great sense of equanimity and balance and peace in the face of the nature of life, of this cycle of life. And that's what sends him off on his search. So it would be easy to conclude that what the practice is about, actually, and you hear some people say this, it's about getting ready for death. You know, that we die not 1,000 times, not 1,000,000 times, millions of times. We're born and die over and over and over and over again, our identity and suffering through this process. And while that's close, that's not actually it. So that's the next part I'd like to talk about. If you look at the Buddha's practice for 7 years, which was just an extraordinary commitment with amazing determination, it's all coming from the place personally that resulted in the shock and destabilization in the first place. It came from a place of attachment and identification. And his reaction was completely personalized. That's the reason his experience was one of destabilization. So not surprisingly, the practices that he gravitated towards are the practices, and we still use a lot of them today, were practices around control and management of our mind states and emotions and our experiences. So, and these usually fall into one of two baskets, either restraint, some kind of restraint, or some kind of development of some skill. So, you know, he developed this extraordinary skill to be able to, in a laser-like way, pinpoint his mind on something and keep it there, and keep it to the exclusion of everything else, so that the things that we normally experience as like the five hindrances would cease. They just completely cease. It's kind of an extraordinary thing to think that you can do that, and people can do it. And he did. And he had, you know, enormous discipline and restraint. You know, he went through both all of these concentration-type practices and then on the other side all of these austerity practices where you're denying urges, not just emotional and psychological of the body, but you're denying its physical needs. You know, and almost everybody has seen the depictions of him where he's eating so little that he's basically a skeleton, you know, and he almost went right up to the verge of killing himself through practice. So, but these are all control techniques. You know, he wasn't seeking insight. So at some point, he has this experience that feels like maybe he's arrived. And there's a complete cessation of desire and aversion and doubt and restlessness and anxiety. His mind's in this completely open, freed place that isn't identified with the body. He goes back to his teacher at the time. It's said that he studied with the two premier teachers of his generation. He describes it to them and asks them if he's become awakened. And he's told that, yes, he is. And it's a seminal moment because he knows that that's not true. And the reason he knows it's not true is that once he comes out of this rarefied state, even though he's been very advanced in terms of his qualities of mind, including his heart, he's still feeling the tug and pull of attachment and identification. So he realizes that he hasn't done what is described in the literature, and the only way that you could maintain that would be to remain in isolation and doing these practices, and that it's not something that he can take with him anyplace. So he's disillusioned. He kind of takes a break. He nourishes himself. He restores his bodily strength. He kind of relaxes, and he has a recollection of a moment when he was a young boy, and it's a moment of when his mind was relaxed. He'd been kind of concentrating, and then his mind was relaxed and opened, and an insight that he had. And this points him towards, he realizes that the way he's been practicing will not release him from the suffering associated with old age, sickness, and death, and the fear and anxiety with that. He realizes it's not going to work. So he says, well, I'll try something new. And then there's the story of the night of awakening. And he continues to use the kind of concentration and control methods to keep his mind stable and equanimous. But, you know, the description is he goes through this enormous kind of fight with all of his own internal demons that come out. But he stays open, and the focus is on trying to understand what the cause of his anxiety and his suffering is, as opposed to trying to control it. This is the importance of that night. And he is rewarded, these years of practice and development of the mind, where his mind opens and he has a series of insights. And the first one basically is about the cycle of life, you know, that people live and die, and that there's this commonality. But the important feature is that there are causes and conditions that govern birth and living and death that he sees during this night. He has another and more important insight, and that is that within the cycle of life, there is a cycle of suffering. And that the cycle of suffering also is governed by a process of causes and conditions, that it is not random. And that eventually becomes the underpinning of all teachings. If you take the principle of causation and conditionality out of all of the teachings, you no longer have Buddhist practice. You have a lot of practices, you don't have Buddhist practice. You know, I'll try to explain that in just a second. But he has this extraordinary insight that he thought the problem was old age, sickness, and death, was living and dying, this process. And he realizes that that's not the problem. The problem is the suffering associated with old age, sickness, and death. That if you didn't suffer, that the process itself wouldn't be that big of a deal. You know, that you could deal with it, that there are difficulties, but that the suffering is really the key issue. And he sees through these causes and conditions that the seminal reason for the suffering has to do with grasping, desire and aversion, moving into what we call attachment and identification. That once that sets in, you begin to suffer. And there's a way that happens, and that you can understand it, and you can understand how to get out of it. And so there becomes the key moment of that night, which then leads to the principles of cause and conditions and conditionality, which underpin every teaching in Buddhist practice. You know, you can just start naming them off, and if they weren't there, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, dependent originate, just every single one of those, if you take it out, it's no longer what the Buddha was teaching. Okay. So for me, that's a significant distinction, you know, that he sees that the problem isn't death and dying, the problem is suffering associated with death and dying, and that's the reason in the Four Noble Truths, there's no explicit talk about death and dying. It's about suffering, globally, and then applied to death and dying. So if you can see the cycle of suffering, which is the wheel of life that's depicted on this Tibetan tanka over here, that embodies one aspect of the teaching of causality. If you can see that, then it transforms, or potentially transforms, your experience of life and death. And that's, in my opinion, what you see in Steve Armstrong, is you know, both as a scholar and then as a teacher, his understanding of this is so deep, and he has practiced in a particular way, that was recommended by the Buddha, and with a lifetime of that practice, when you come to this stage, you're able to open to it with a level of acceptance and equanimity that is not available to others, and is pretty extraordinary. So the language that the Buddha used in describing this wasn't the kind of psychological, clinical language that we use. You know, we talk about desire and aversion, which traditionally together are referred to as grasping. Okay. Moving into attachment, and then identification. And then once that's there, control and management, you know, those are hand and glove. You know, they're feeding each other. The mind that's identified and attached wants to control things around what it's attached to. And one of the attachments is, of course, our own ego. So we're trying to protect that or build it up or something, you know. So you can just slowly trace everything back once you understand the principle. But the Buddha didn't use that language. The Buddha talked about becoming, about being born, and then about the cessation or death of suffering. So he actually thought of and encapsulated suffering as a living life cycle, as a living thing. That's the model that he laid out. You know, it's really fascinating, and that's the language that they used. So it's easy to kind of make it complex and difficult, but in the end, if you're paying attention, you know, the way he encourages to do, it's not that difficult. So I just have two quotations here. One is that the Buddha was talking about causes and conditions coming together in a particular way, that they weren't random. So this little thing is quoted in hundreds of suttas. Okay, so the Buddha said, when this is, that comes into being. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. So if you have, you know, different states of mind. I'm going to use an illustration in a moment, but the basic idea is if this is present, it's the precondition to that arising. Okay? That's what we're actually looking for, both in life and when we're sitting, in terms of causation. When this ceases, that ceases. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. So the entire idea is that things are dependent and conditioned on each other. My favorite quote on this is from Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was a very, very famous, couple generations before us, famous Thai teacher. And interestingly, he was a very successful businessman before he became a teacher, and then became arguably, in the Thai tradition, the most famous and influential teacher. And Buddhadasa says, everything that happens has causes and conditions, proceeds according to causes and conditions, and leads to results in line with those causes and conditions. So it's not that it's predetermined, but the principle is that there are a set of underlying causes and conditions that are driving everything. And this is the principle, by the way, that replaces the notion of a supreme being or an all-knowing exterior force in all the other religious traditions. Causation is the explanation of why things happen and is the thing that makes Buddhism one of the four great religions, even though there's no deity or anything close to a deity. You know, this is the kind of talk where there's a bunch of things in here. You know, this is probably, you go through this, and the Buddha spent a lot of time piercing apart all of these different ideas. So we can do that one night. But for me, it's fascinating, because one of the things, before I found Eastern thought and started exploring that, I was raised in a Catholic family, and it just never worked for me. And it was a very traditional family. My mother was a little old Italian, second generation. And, you know, she believed that the Pope was, in fact, the incarnate, you know, of the prior Pope and that whole lineage. When they built the Catholic Church in my neighborhood, my father flew to Rome and met with the Pope and brought back the relic of Saint Bernadette. That every Catholic church has a relic in the... So, I mean, I was in a pretty Catholic family. So to say that I got pushback, you know, about not getting it or not believing it or not what have you, you know. But the whole notion never worked for me for a bunch of reasons, but... When I eventually found this, you know, I did a lot of Hindu practice before I came to Buddhism, and then before I got to Theravadan Buddhism. But as much as there were so many things in Hindu practice that were so powerful and so valuable for me, and my first really seriously important teacher, face-to-face teacher, you know, not like you read them or hear them on tape or something, that I studied with for years was a Hindu. Ram Dass, and to the moment I die, I will be thankful for him, you know, and for his teachings. But the system just didn't work. And then I found Buddhist practice, and in particular, I found this causation, and it was the thing that somehow created the shift in me. That it just provided all, it all made sense to me. So, in the traditional description of this, causes are considered like an origin or a root or a seed. It's something that's already there, kind of waiting to be watered. So whatever is present is dependent on the existence of whatever that is to come into being. So the illustration that I've been using in the last couple of talks and we're all familiar with is hearing consciousness. Okay, so you've got an eardrum that's working. We've got the bowl. We have a striker. That creates a sound wave. It goes out, touches your ear. You can hear that unless you have a damaged ear, right? Eardrum. Okay. So if you remove any any one of these, like we no longer have a striker, and I don't use my hand, that can sit there all day long and you're not going to hear it, right? If I have a striker and we don't have this, you're not going to hear the sound. If I try to hit it and I miss, so there's no sound wave, you're not going to hear it. If your eardrum is damaged, you will hear something, but you won't hear that. You'll hear something else. And depending on how seriously your eardrum is damaged, maybe you don't hear it. Or if you're distracted, you don't hear that. You hear something else. Or let's say you've been on retreats and there was a bell just like this one. And those retreats were magical for you. You know, they were important. You had some significant insights. Will you hear this? And it's wonderful. You just instantaneously begin to relax and feel open. It brings you back to that place. Or let's say that you had early in your life some significant trauma that was associated with the sound of a bell. We could make up a lot of stories, but let's just say that. So you hear this, and it immediately, at some deep place in you, puts you on edge. Okay. So in the end, what the Buddha was saying with the notion of causes and conditions is that causes and conditions are coming together, and they come together in each moment in a unique pattern. Each one of those things I just described would create a different experience, right? And so conditions come together, something arises from those conditions. Fear, anger, love, distrust, trust. And as long as those conditions are in place, that will be there. And the minute that they start to change, that experience changes. And at some point, it ceases. So we're in a meeting, and both of us know each other well. And I think I know who you are, and you think you know who I am. And we get in a very unguarded discussion. And I say something to you that challenges your notion of who you think I am and the level at which you can trust me. Or the look on my face or the tone of my voice. And the moment before, we had come together, there were a set of conditions that allowed us to be open and caring and receptive to each other. And that single moment, that one condition, changes all of that. Boom, it's changed. And to get back to the moment just before it is nearly impossible. It maybe takes years. Right? So the number of changing conditions in any given period are extraordinary. And they can be very complex. I mean, just think of the number of, and this is the reason, by the way, that we talk about moment-to-moment awareness. Thich Nhat Hanh used to have this thing. I just loved it. And he'd say, pay attention. Be awake. Because the moment may come when there's an opportunity for you. And if you're not there, you'll miss the opportunity. During the time of the Buddha, people would listen to Dharma talks. And during the listening of the Dharma talk, a moment would come and the years of their practice, their karma, and the power of the Buddha's presence in his words, a moment would come, this one moment, and people, it is said, would become awakened by hearing a moment of a Dharma talk with the Buddha. That challenges all of our notions of awakening. Has that happened to anybody tonight so far? By the way, I just want to check. No, you're probably embarrassed to say it. But you know the notion that if you take this, you know this, which is a simple thing, you know these conditions, and then you think about our relationships, how significant a notion this is, and how challenging it is, because most of the time, we're not really paying attention, or at some level of attention, but not at the level of attention that we're talking about right now, which the Buddha was trying to encourage us to try to do, because we can see this. We can see causes, we can see conditions. You know, the extended version of causes and conditions is the principle of dependent origination. You know, this specific rolling out of how attachment and identification occurs. But if we just pay attention to our body, watch our mind, watch the tone of our voice, we can see when we're starting to lock up, when we're starting to hold on. We can see when we're identified. And the minute we are, you do not have attachment and identification without suffering. Period. So this is exciting, and why the Buddha contended that this was not, you know, nihilistic or narcissistic or negative. It's just the reverse. It's completely hopeful. Because if you understand at least even the idea of this, you understand that whatever is present now can change. And if you watch closely, what you begin to understand is that everything is changing all the time. And this is the reason it's so challenging. You know, and there's a whole stage of practice, you know, intense practice, meditation practice on the cushion, you know, called rolling up the mat. And it's when you actually see, you actually get it, that everything is changing all the time. And you can't let go enough to fall into it and let it flow over you and become a source of power or empowerment rather than a source of fear. And I think every good practitioner has that moment. And it's the difference between whether you stay or whether you walk away. Because you'll have these moments and you'll really get it of how contingent and how temporary everything is and how vulnerable we potentially are. You know, our relationships, our physical presence. But if you can go past that, then it's this extraordinary possibility of what may actually be possible. The worst thing that you think about yourself, you realize, is the result of conditions coming together. So every time that I think that thought about myself that is punishing, that we don't want to reveal to anyone else, or that we do and we feel terrible about it, we realize that that thought coming together and that feeling is the result of causes and conditions coming together. It's a thought. It isn't necessarily true at all. And if it has some conventional real-world truth to it, the fact that things are changing and coming together and arising and then dissipating gives us the hope that whatever that is, we can change it. We can modify it. It's just extraordinary. And there's another word for that. It's called transformation. It's this very powerful change. But in this tradition, the change is driven by a very conscious intention and a set of practices to see causes and conditions move forward. So the Buddha said, and this isn't going to surprise you, but and in some way it's a disappointment because it just brings it home of what the practice is about. The Buddha said that at least with respect, you know, there's general causation and then there's more specific causation. And here we're talking about the causation of suffering, right? So the Buddha said that in every instance where there's suffering, there are three ultimate core causes, seeds, roots. And that what we do is we get confused in identifying the conditions that are triggering the causes as the problem. And that we work on the conditions that are triggering it, thinking that we're getting someplace, when what we need to be doing is undermining the ultimate cause. So there can be great value in working on a condition that's triggering something. It's going to involve restraint or cultivation and management and control primarily. And then the cause itself, management and control will never eliminate those. The only way that those get eliminated is through this deep seeing, this deep experience of being willing to be with and attend to something and keep watching it in the deepest possible way until it reveals itself, like his night of awakening. So the three things are, first, desire. You know, that our mind, if we honestly watch it, wants to have things the way that we want it to. If they are the way we want it, we don't want it to change. And if it does start to change, we want it to change in such a way that we end up with things being the way our mind wants them to be. Okay. The second one is aversion, that I don't want things the way they are, so I want them to change, and I want them to change into something that I want. Those are these just two basic drives. And then the question is, I mean, everybody here knows that those are fundamental drives that we all have, and we also know that they're disastrous. And all of us probably also know that we just keep doing it over and over again. And so then the question is, well, why do we do that? And that is the third cause, which is related to causes and conditions, and that is what the Buddha called delusion or illusion. It's basically confusion about how suffering arises and is maintained and then ceases, and how happiness arises and ceases. And so within that, there are a number of them, but the two primary ones are, the first is that this unstated but constant principle that we're operating on, that if we just keep wanting something a particular way, and if we just keep resisting what we don't want, that somehow that will happen. That these states that we know are actually temporary, that we're trying to turn them into something that is permanent, that is not temporary. And that's absolutely impossible, and it's absolutely impossible because of causes and conditions. because everything is changing moment to moment depending on conditions, so it's impossible for it to be stable, to be secure, and to be certain. And that's what we keep shooting for. That's the desire. That's what's behind I want it my way. Stability, security, certainty. Okay? And the second one is that the same thing, that somehow if we keep desiring things and keep resisting things, that we will create a situation where we are separate and independent and can control, use our control to have some kind of continuous happiness. And that is absolutely impossible because of causes and conditions. Because if it's true, and it's, you can test it out for yourself, if everything is coming together and falling apart, and coming together and falling apart, and coming together and falling apart, it's impossible for there to be anything that's independent, that is separate, and that is permanent. And if it were, this could never happen. So that's anicca and anatta. That everything is constantly changing beyond our control. And because it's constantly changing, there is nothing that is separate and independent. That everything is interconnected and dependent or conditioned by the experience that precedes it or that is mutually arising with it. So if we were actually able to direct our attention in at that level in some, you know, fairly consistent way, the possibilities of what we could understand about the structure of our own life and how we're causing ourselves to suffer are really significant. So I want to use a real quick illustration of something that I've been dealing with for a couple of years, and I want to tell you that this is not a success story. It's my story on how difficult it can be to work with causes and conditions. So let's see. Okay. So there's different parts to this that I see at different times, so I took some notes to try to get at least the majority of the story out. So all of us, probably everybody here has what's called a floater in their eye. Yes? Yeah, does everybody know what a floater is? It's this little thing, and you know, and most of them are small, and what happens is that in the vast majority of times, you know, 90-95%, your brain within 4 to 8 months, sometimes a year, just absorbs that as part of the scenery. It doesn't even see it anymore. Okay, so as an illustration, when I was younger, in my right eye, I started playing racquetball. And this is obviously before I started practicing Buddhism, because I didn't understand cause and effect, that I wasn't wearing glasses, protective glasses. So I'm out there, and you know, somebody hits the ball. I go up close to the wall, hit the ball back, and then my partner, my racquetball partner, decides he's just going to hit this screaming, you know, ball. He used to like to do that. Like if I was close to the wall, he'd like to hit something really hard just to scare the poop out of me, you know. So he does it, and it just at the right angle goes into the corner so that it hits both corners and comes up and hits me in the eye. So in this right eye, I lost 20% of my vision. And for quite a long time, I knew that I had lost it, because when I would look, my brain just involuntarily would notice that the spatially that there was a part on my right eye that I wasn't seeing where on my left eye. And then pretty soon my right eye, my brain just absorbed that, and I don't even know that anymore, you know. And occasionally it'll kind of get pointed out to me because somebody will say, well, what do you think of that thing over there? And like, I don't see it. Okay. So over the, as part of old age, sickness, and death, I've had both of my eyes cataracts surgery, transplant, and what have you. And sometimes with cataract surgery and then sometimes just with aging, there's this, I won't get all the technical terms, but there's this little membrane behind your eye that, for a bunch of different reasons, starts to tear. And depending on how bad it is, they go in and repair it. And if it's not, they don't. So the result of this is that I have a series of floaters that are in my eye. They're quite large, and they're right in the center of your line of vision, which most of the time they're not. So what's been, and this is now, I'm at maybe 18 months that this is going on, so I don't have any reason to believe that what I'm describing is going to stop. Okay, the doctors are kind of surprised about it, and they don't want to do surgery for a number of different reasons. But this is what happens. If I walk out of my house, and unless it's night, if it's a normal day, even if it's overcast, moving from a room like this where there's a lot of different things, so my eye, like right now, is not seeing that. You walk outside, and suddenly it's this open expanse, or like when you're driving, there's the cars in front of you, and my mind starts to see this, and a number of things start to happen. The first thing is my mind, first of all, after 18 months, interprets that as something actually being out there, outside of my body, that if I just move my head, won't be obstructing my view anymore. So, and this now has happened thousands of times, and it still happens. You know, I'm driving, and I find myself going like this, you know, like, what the hell am I doing? And literally my mind is telling me, move your head because something is obstructing your view. Okay. So then we'll do this a couple of times, and I guess my mind kind of gets it. This is another thing about who am I, you know, and how much control we actually have. Okay. So then at some point my mind kind of realized, well, there isn't anything out there. And what does it say? It says, well, there must be something in my eye. So then my eye involuntarily starts to water to protect itself, to try to get whatever's in there out. Okay? Every time I go out of my house, this happens. And the only kind of part, apart from practice, the only kind of like dramatic real world change that I've been able to invoke is wear sunglasses. So I almost wear sunglasses all the time, even if it's overcast, because it's just enough that my brain doesn't see that and react to it. Okay. If I'm working on my computer, depending on what's on the screen, what I'm describing starts to happen, you know, if it's an all-white screen with it. So I'm doing the same thing. You know, it's like my head's moving and then my eyes watering. Now, it's kind of like dying, you know. If this was happening and I wasn't suffering, it wouldn't be a big deal. But my mind has decided to really suffer about this, okay? So this involuntarily looking for things, and then they're not there, and then my eye's watering, and then because there's too much water in my eye begins to get irritated, and after this goes on for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, I have to tell you, I'm really pissed off. You know, so it starts off as kind of, you know, an annoyance, and then it's frustration, and then I start to feel really angry, and then I start to feel really anxious. You know, that like I can't rely on, and it's completely irrational, but it starts to become psychological. You know, it's like I start to feel destabilized because my eye isn't working right. It's doing all this stuff. You know, I wonder if anything else is happening. You know, and then I start getting these random, really pleasant thoughts like, well, I wonder if the real thing isn't that that this is detached. I wonder if I have a stroke. I wonder if I should start watching my speech and I should start watching this. And I start feeling like disabled, defective, you know, kind of this global sense of there's something wrong with me. And then it goes into, you know, well, I'm aging and what's the next goddamn thing going to be? And something's going to happen to me and I'm going to be a burden on my daughter. And if I don't get a hold of that pretty quick, man, that could just spin out of control and go. So relating this, so the question is, well, what is the cause of that? And I think it would be real easy to look at that and say, well, the cause, it's obvious. It's those goddamn floaters. Right? I mean, if that thing wasn't sitting there in the middle of your eye, none of this would be happening. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's the wrong answer. The answer is that my mind and my entire being is attached and identified with an outdated model of what that I actually is and doesn't want to accept it, wants to resist it, is wanting it to change, and is resisting it with all its power, and I know that, and it's still happening. So this story of the Buddha, there's basically two big baskets of practice. One is things that you can do to control things, either by developing certain qualities, you know, like you can develop certain qualities to offset the hindrances. Well, there's things, qualities that I can develop in my mind and approaches to offset the desire, to offset the aversion, to cut off the anxiety. And you can learn how to do those where the hindrances will cease. That doesn't liberate the mind. That's happening because you're controlling things. So you have to do that, you know. If you don't do that, or at least if I, in the situation, this thing would really be miserable. But that's not the answer, because the floater and the anxiety and the anger and are not ultimately the cause on the real problem. The real problem is this underlying attachment to an outdated model of what my mind thinks that I is. And until I am able, through sitting and watching that enough and deeply enough, to see into the true nature of that experience so that insight begins to reveal itself to me at this very deep nonverbal level, this will continue to happen. That will not change. But once it does, I'll know it's starting to change because the reaction's going to start to change. I'll still see the floater, and these reactions will change. That's how I'll know.
Are you saying that you need to accept that this is the new I?
I need to accept it's the old I. the nature of the I has changed, and my mind is resisting that. Okay, so intellectually I know that. Intellectually I've accepted it. I haven't accepted it at this deep, nonverbal, psychological, emotional level that deep practice targets. And it's that which will cure the suffering. It won't cure the I, it'll cure the suffering. Okay. So for me, this is very instructive, you know, because it's troubling. It's not something I can get out of. There's no easy fix. It keeps slapping me around, and I can see it, you know, and I can see my mind wanting to, like, blame the floater or think that what I really ought to be doing is working on my anger, you know, or really working on how irrational those thoughts are. And I'm doing all of that, but that's not the real work. That's not the real work if I want to liberate my mind from this suffering. So I think this is an illustration of where I started it, and with Steve. You know, you are born into suffering and watch it, and it dies because the causes and conditions change. You begin to see that if you work with those causes and conditions, that you can move suffering into a place where it does cease. And then you can do that more consistently. So you do that in a lifetime, I mean, millions and millions of times. And as you do that, the thing that is really exciting about this as a practitioner is that once you start to see this, it starts leading into all kinds of things. You begin to understand that there are things in your life you can control and those that you can't. And just seeing that really deeply shifts everything. It's like, I don't have to worry about those other things now. I can just relax. You know, I can do just what Thich Nhat Hanh said. Just be awake, be ready, keep watching, because the opportunity may present itself, those conditions that come together. My role is to see that and to make a wise decision in relationship to my suffering. That's the whole ballgame. And once that starts to happen, things become less personal. I know that my description of these, anger, resentment, fear, anxiety, all highly personalized, identified, attached mind states. Despite all of that, except when I'm just like over the edge, you know, really pissed off, there's a part of me that is just so clear that those are mind states that are arising from causes and conditions. And even though they're really powerful, there's a part of me that's not believing it. It's hard to put into words. But it provides you with kind of like a sense of confidence that you can do this. You know, even with some of your worst suffering. And so when that starts to happen, and then you feel less attached, less identified, it's less personal, spontaneously you just start to feel more connected and in relationship with others in the world around you. Because what all this reactivity and attachment and identification is about ego. It's about narcissism. And once you see this, once it pierces through, and you have even a little sense at some deep level that it's all causes and conditions, it creates this huge shift in how you feel about your place in the world and your relationship to others in the world. So in the same way that conditions are coming together, you realize that people are part of those conditions. You know, and that we're all influencing each other, you know, and that's where Thich Nhat Hanh and others use this, you know, co-creation, co-arising, all of that. So I think that this is an enormously hopeful part of Buddhist practice. I would encourage you to investigate it. There's a lot of ways to do it. There's a lot of good material on it. I would encourage you to use Steve's life and his death as a point of inspiration to follow the caring bridge and seeing what is possible, you know, as a human being with this practice.
So I want to bring this back to this and that. And this is the feeling, and that is the thought. And pretty soon the two get jumbled in. The thoughts and the feelings and the thoughts, and they begin to interact.
That's right.
And in that interaction, I get lost in the translation. I remember the feelings. The feelings that made me angry, made me fearful. And there was no thoughts then. The thoughts came after. And then the thoughts became delusional. And then it brought back the feelings. And then the feelings didn't go away. I became attached to the feelings. And so the this and that, the pain and the suffering, the pain and the suffering. And it's a cycle. A never-ending cycle.
I'm with you up until that statement.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's never-ending for me.
Let's word it this way. It's never-ending for you up to this point.
Yes. And so there's the habits, the unconscious.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, though. You know, on that cycle and these feelings, are the feelings, the intensity of the feelings and the control that they have over you the same now, today, as when you first started having those feelings? Has your ability to work with it, see it, do some of these practices changed the strength or intensity or frequency of them?
Well, it's not something that I did. It's something that we did.
Okay. So does that mean yes?
Yes.
And yeah.
So what this has meant, what we have meant, is it has brought a desire. And with that desire comes a new feeling. And so the old feeling goes away. The old desires go away. The new desire takes its place. And in the practice, there is an opportunity to stay in the moment of the desire. And that has been the value, and that has been the opportunity for transformation.
So I just want to point out a positive thing, a positive contradiction, that if that last part is true, that there have been feelings that you've had, and as a result of the global impact of practice, those have been replaced and are no longer there. The statement that you started with, that they're never ending, is inaccurate.
Inaccurate?
Inaccurate. Because you're saying that the feelings aren't there anymore. They've been replaced with positive feelings. So, you know, this is a lifetime's work. And my guess is that anyone here, and I'll just conclude with this, anyone here who has practiced for a while, you know, 10 years or more, can look back and see that there were psychological, emotional issues, feelings that they were dealing with that have significantly changed or aren't present any longer. Once again, it's all causes and conditions, depending on the type of practice, the particular type of practice you do, the amount of time and effort you spend, your intention in particular of what you're trying to accomplish, and the kind of support that you have. Those are all causes and conditions. And so people will say, well, gee, I've been practicing for so long and X has or hasn't happened. And the way I hear those reports is just causes and conditions. It prompts me to ask questions. So people will say, well, what should I do about X? And you really can't answer that question unless you know some of the context What are the causes and conditions? Because one person may have worked on whatever it is for years, and another person has worked on it for a week or hasn't worked on it at all, or one person has been working with it to understand it, and the other person has been working to control it. So this is kind of the diagnostic thing that we all need to do with our own practices. What are the causes and conditions of our practice? And then, you know, what you just said for me is part of the exciting thing about this practice, that transformation is possible. It really is possible if you have a positive aspiration and you study the practice. So I better let us go. It's 9:20. I apologize. Thank you very much. We'll probably follow that. I think my next talk will be part two, and I'll give a short talk and then mostly Q&A and discussion. Okay? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.